Clay. I'll just fill in a few little missing bits from my bio. So the main thing really is that now what I really enjoy doing, I'm retired, and for the last 5 years I've also been teaching young people Buddhism. So that's really my that's my main thing, my most enjoyable thing, I guess, that I do now. I still have, I still lead adult meditation classes, and I belong to a couple of different sanghas during the week that I go to regularly. But I teach 4 primary school classes, so from kindergarten, 5 years, up to year 6, and I also teach at a high school, Sydney Boys High, once a week. When I say teach, I lead one class, maybe. And so I really enjoy being able to sort of bring the Dharma in its practical forms and relevant to that particular age group. You know, I really enjoy that. And I think, you know, if you can teach the basics of the Buddha's teachings to 5-year-olds, then 25-year-olds and 85-year-olds, it's very easy. I'm a Buddhist, so that's also a good start. I have been since 1995. I was fortunate enough to take a lamp transmission, which is to become a Dharma teacher, with Thich Nhat Hanh, who was my teacher. That was in 2004. So when we when we learn about the Dharma, there's a teaching which I think is very helpful for us, which reminds us to have, say, an open mind and to stay receptive to things. As the teaching of the 3 pots. I don't know if you've heard this, but it's this idea that our mind can be like 3 pots. And the first pot is a full pot. It's like if this was a pot, it's completely full. It's full of things like our ideas, our knowledge, our notions about things. Even our opinions. So, mostly we think our opinions are right too. I mean, our opinions are right, the other person don't really think their opinions are okay. We may not tell them, but just silently we think that. So that's the first pot. And needless to say, all of these pots are reminders of how our mind can be. The second pot is sometimes called the poison pot. So that's the pot that sort of, it complains about things. It can be judgmental. So there's a little bit of that, you know, in the first pot, because we've got an opinion, but the other person's opinion, nah, don't like that. So it can be also cynical. You know, we could come up with lots of terms that are in that poison pot. And the third pot is the sort of leaky pot. It's got a crack in it or a hole in it. And it's like our mind when we can't sort of keep our attention on one thing for too long. It's always daydreaming. The leaky pot's always daydreaming. It's always somewhere else. It's not being mindful. The mindfulness is when we can give our attention to what's going on. And the leaky pot, it's in that automatic pilot sort of mode. And there's nothing wrong with that. that automatic pilot mode is anything that we've learned how to do. We've learned to walk, or we've learned to drive a car, we've learned to write. We don't really have to give our attention to that when we do it again, because once we've mastered it, our subconscious knows it and understands it. We don't think, okay, I'm driving the car now, oh, I've got a red light, I've got to put my foot on the brake, lift my foot up, No. We don't have to think about that. It just happens automatically. In fact, you know, I could have driven all the way from my house to here tonight, and my mind could have been somewhere else, because my body and my mind can do it unconsciously. And you think about all the things you've learned, you can do it in that way. Even the way you've learned to walk, the way you've learned to talk. To some extent, the way we've learned to think about things. So, mindfulness, by definition, is to be aware, to switch the light on in our head of our conscious mind, what's really there in front of us now. What we're seeing, what we're hearing, we can smell, taste, touch, all of those things, all of those senses that come in and they feed into your conscious mind. It's what's there in front of you. And to be aware of that. So when we're sitting there and we're paying attention to our breath, what we're doing is we're giving attention to our breath, and we sort of close our eyes so we don't try to get distracted by anything, or we shut our eyes down a bit. We're using mindfulness in that. And whenever we do that, whenever we bring mindfulness into our conscious mind like that, it's then that we're actually really in the present moment. So we can still be in the present moment and be distracted by lots of things, and that's not mindfulness either. So just to be aware of those three things is to be aware of how our mind can be. And it might not be one or the other, it could be a combination of any of those three, just those three images of those three pots. I think we can also learn from fact always that what are we preventing, what are we withholding back from ourselves when our mind is like one of those three pots. So, you know, if our mind's too full, if we think, you know, we know everything and there's nothing to learn, of course nobody would say that, but because we're all too humble and polite to do that, but you know, there's no room for learning. There's no room for anything new to come in. We're not going to learn anything new. And if we've always got the poison pot on, you know, the cynical, judgmental, you know, the sort of negative, maybe, approach to things, then, you know, we're not leaving any room for joy, for gratitude, for a sense of wonder about what's going on. And the last one, of course, if we can't hold our attention, if we can't hold anything in the pot of our mind, if it's leaky all the time, if our mind's always pouring out somewhere else, it's like we're just being superficial. We're just leading like a shadow of our life in a way. Because we can't hold our attention to anything. You know, a friend's talking to us and we can't even listen to them, finish their conversation or what they've got to say. Our mind sort of goes off somewhere else. We're thinking about what we're going to say next. So being able to hold our attention and develop our mindfulness leads to us being able to develop a certain amount of concentration. And, you know, it's not necessarily I've got to really try hard and concentrate. It's a relaxed way of just maintaining your attention to things. So that's what it means to be having a non-leaky pot. Fix the leak. So that's just something to remember when we hear any talk, but it's something to remember about our mind generally. And it's one of the teachings that can help us. pressing delete. Okay, and is it?
How I say your name correctly?
Okay, that's good. Yeah, I had to ring her up today and ask her, what is this? This talks about karma. What's this pressing delete? I don't get it at all. So she was kind enough to explain. Would you like to explain again? Can we get rid of our karma by just pressing a button? Is that basically it? Yeah. The first thing I'd like to know from you, I'll just do a bit of a straw poll, maybe you can just sort of give me a bit of feedback on it. Karma. I think it's something that there's lots of definitions people have of it. I mean, what is your definition of karma? Someone, come on, everyone volunteer. What do you think karma is? What goes around comes around. Yep. There's no right or wrong answers here. No one's going to... One of the things is we're going to have an attitude in this class this evening. It's going to be the attitude of non-judgment. Okay. I know you're already judging me. It's okay. I don't mind. That's okay. You can judge me. Oh, this guy. Who is he? Why should we listen to him? He's not a monk or a nun. Just a layperson. So I think we can feel that we're not going to be judged. And I think, in any group, in any sangha, it's a very important thing. And I think that your group is wonderful, that you guys are so lucky that you have a group who want to come together and, enjoy each other's company, but you sort of, the thing that brings you together is the Buddha's teachings. So to me, that's a sangha. I know in some places you have to be a monk or a nun, they think of that as sangha. But to me, it includes lay people and lay men and lay women as well. And I know in our cultures that's not exactly how it's seen. But in the Buddha's time, he saw that too. The lay people wore white robes. So, come on. We'll just go around everyone. Yeah?
Action.
Ooh. You've heard my talks before.
Yeah, what I learned is the intentions to do something. That's what it's called karma.
Okay, so it's intention. What do you mean by intention? Can you give me an example of that?
I'm not really good in English, but it's a how. It's like what you want, or it's the initial. So it's coming from the mind.
Okay. So it's what you want to happen. Something else? What do you think?
Consequences.
Okay, so consequences of your actions. Yeah. Anyone else have something to add? No? Okay. So I think... all of those things are quite valid. Sometimes people have ideas about karma that, or maybe they lean to or tend to think that karma, when they talk about karma, maybe in general terms, that it is more about bad karma. Okay. But karma can be good or bad if we want to attach adjectives to it. It can be wholesome, it can have wholesome consequences, wholesome results. Sometimes they say the results is, the word is used as retribution, karmic retribution. So, but it could be good or bad if we want to attach those names to it. Although, sometimes if we're really being non-judgmental, there's just consequences. And when we talk about action in terms of karma, we're not just talking about actions of our body. It also, I think, includes the action of our speech and even of our thinking, of our thoughts. Because if I'm going to do something, then generally speaking, most of the time, and not all the time, but most of the time, I'm going to think about it first. First of all, I'll have the thought before I do something. I'll have the thought about it before I speak it. Whether that thought comes up very quickly, and I have a chance to stop myself, and I say it anyway, because someone's upset me, and so I cut me off when I'm driving in the car here, and I swear at that person in my car, only I'm the one who hears it, as an example. Try not to. Not perfect. Sometimes those things come up very quickly, but still the thought there or the habit energy is there. It's in our, it comes from our mind first. So we can have, so karma can relate to thoughts, speech and action. I think it's also helpful to understand the Buddhist view of right view when it comes to karma. So essentially what we're saying with karma is that if we do good things should come around to us. Is that how you would understand? And if you do something that you might regret, then you wish you hadn't done, it's going to be, you know, you've hurt someone with something you've said or you've done. And sometimes we don't know what effect we will say something and it'll have a bad effect on somebody. It'll upset them. And maybe we feel like we've been misunderstood. So we need to have the view, the right view as well. Because otherwise karma can be more like something that's a bit superstitious. It can be a view of karma that's like superstitious. But people can say, that person, that's just her karma. And when we have that view, we just, that's from a view of our point of view. In other words, a view of self. So some of the views that we can have that can create suffering for us is to have just a view of ourself. It's a very narrow view where it's only looking outwards. We have no concern for the other person who may see things differently or hear things differently, understand things differently. We only have our view. So the first thing about right view is to bring compassion to our view, which means to be able to maybe put ourselves in the other person's shoes, not just see things from our own perspective. Sometimes that takes practice. To have compassion is also to have a desire to help somebody else who's in difficulty or in pain, to relieve the suffering of someone else, not us, not just us. So we sort of have a mindset that's caring and concerned about the other person as well. So all of this is related to our action, to our speech, to our thinking. And there's a number of things we can have. We can sometimes call this the eyes of compassion. And there's another thing with right view, which is to see that that we are not just an independent individual, that we are made up of a lot of things. There's been input from our parents in DNA into our genes. There's been input to in our experiences, how we were brought up, how we were schooled, what we were taught. Did we have good mentors, good teachers? All of these things. What about our friends? Did we have good friends that helped us? Or maybe we didn't have those things. And so, all of those things go into making up who we are. We're not just an independent self as well. So this is looking with the eyes of non-self and seeing that, in fact, we're all, one of the words that gets used for this is we're all manifestations. Okay, and that means that there are all sorts of causes and conditions that go into making someone up. And when we understand those causes and conditions, or that there are causes and conditions, they can help us to look and to better understand, not just ourselves, but to better understand other people. So we just don't assume that everyone's been brought up like I have. That's why we all don't have the same opinions. Not everyone has the same experience. They haven't been as lucky to have the same teachers that I had. Or they had different teachers. Maybe they were luckier. And maybe they see things that I don't see. And that's why we have misunderstandings. And maybe they experience things differently. You know, my eyesight's not so good. Well, it just, as you get old, everyone needs reading glasses. I'm not saying that there should be anything, we should expect there to be perfect health. I don't think there is such a thing. That's not to say that we shouldn't try to keep ourselves healthy, look after our bodies and our minds. But it's just that we're all different. And maybe, you know, people hear things differently even. They just experience things differently. I don't know, is anyone interested in soccer? Football? My son plays football, and he's in, my youngest son, he's in the under-15s. And they have a very good team. They can get the ball up to the net, but we don't really have a striker in the team. You know what a striker is? The person who normally scores the goals. What a striker has to do is they have to sort of, when the ball comes to them, they just don't have to think about it. They just got to kick it quickly. Because even in half a second, if you delay having a shot at goal when the goal's open, the defence can come over, someone gets their foot in the way, or the goalkeeper has that extra time to go and save the ball. So if you can't shoot instinctively, sometimes we, you know, us experts on the sideline like to say, pull the trigger or just go boom. If you can't do that, then, you're not going to score many goals. But, you know, not everyone has that instinctiveness of being a striker. And in fact, there aren't many really good strikers. Even when you get to the World Cup or, you know, in the Champions League or in the English Premier League or all those things. And I really apologise if you don't know anything about soccer, but these are all really the highest level of football. All I'm trying to say is that most of the players in that team don't have that. And if the ball comes to them and they've got the goal open, and all they've got to do is just like not think about it, but just kick it as soon as it gets there, for some reason they can't do it. But there's one guy in the team who's the striker, and normally that person, if it's a good team and they've got a good striker, who can do that. So we're all different in that way, and we can't expect the other person to be the same as us, to have the same qualities of understanding as we have. And the way to see that is to see that we're all made, we're all sort of made of all of the causes and conditions that come together to make us. If our parents weren't there, we wouldn't exist. And in fact, if the sun wasn't there in the sky, we wouldn't exist. If we think of a cloud, a cloud comes across the sky, but what was the cloud before it was there? Just because you can't see it, yeah, maybe it was water. And it needs the sun to evaporate it and to turn it into it. But it doesn't mean that the cloud wasn't there, or the elements that are now in the cloud that make up the cloud. And when the cloud manifests, it appears. That's what manifest means. It means you show yourself. You reveal yourself. So when we're born, we take our first breath and we think that's the beginning of our life. Well, maybe we understand that we've been in our mum's tummy for 9 months. Whatever it is, we think there's a point when we're born. But there's a Zen Buddhist question. It says, what did your face look like 300 years before you were born. It helps us to look at that. Just because you can't see the water and that is now in the cloud doesn't mean that it wasn't there before. All the elements weren't there before the cloud was there. But they all came together, they combined, and then the cloud exists. It manifests itself. And we are like that too. We are all manifestations. And when causes and conditions are sufficient, compound things manifest. And when causes and conditions are no longer sufficient, then the cloud is no longer there. So it becomes rain, it evaporates, the sun slowly evaporates the form of the cloud. But even after the cloud has disappeared, it doesn't mean that the elements have gone anywhere. Nothing is born and nothing is destroyed. Nothing's created and nothing's destroyed. It may have turned into energy, it may have turned into water and rain, it may have turned into a river, maybe an ocean now. Maybe that water, we've drunk it. Now it's in us, in our cells, in our body, in our bloodstream. So those things are always there. So that just helps us to look into things that occur, and to have a view, not to have a view that's fixed when it comes to karma, to help us to understand how things occur, to look a little bit deeper, not just to look at the form, not just to look at the cover of the book, but to look and see the causes and conditions of our own actions and the actions of others and how they may affect us. One of the things I tell my students this morning is that there's some things you can do which are really helpful. This is a year 7, so, 12 years old. They're very smart kids, very attentive, really good. So I said, slow down, do everything more slowly, talk less. Now I'm going to talk less, so I'm going to listen to the sound of the bell. So this is just an opportunity to stop, come back to our breath. And another thing I say to them is, as many times as you can stop during the day, you can stop, just means stop your thinking, whatever it is, wherever your mind is, just bring it back. And breathe, and that means give attention to your breath. And the last one is smile, because you can enjoy the fact that you've given your mind a rest and that your mind and body have come together, and you're in the present moment. So let's just take a moment with the sound of the bell. We can listen to it, and just for the period that the bell sounds and really fades, we can follow it with our hearing, and we can also be aware of our in-breath and out-breath as we do. I don't know how long, how many breaths you take. It's not as though we need to count them, but we can really try to give our full attention to that sound and then just the rhythm of breathing in and out. A little smile. And just try to stay with that sound for as long as you can hear it. very easy to remember what you have to do. During that period there, you just gave yourself a little bit of space. So space between your thinking, you're able to relax. So it's stop, breathe, and smile. That's very easy to remember because we've got a television station that goes by that name as well. During the day, you're rushing around, got something on your mind, maybe you're angry, maybe someone's upset you, maybe you're regretting things about your karma, or you're thinking about your karma, your opinions or your ideas. Just go, okay, television station, what is it? Oh yeah, stop breathing, smile. I don't know why I bother writing myself notes, because without my reading glasses I can't read anything this time of night. So I guess the question here about karma is that we've perhaps done things in the past where we probably regret them. We continue to feel maybe guilt about things that we've done in the past. We don't feel good about it. Maybe we can't stop those things coming back, those thoughts coming back. So that's just a distraction for us. And we sort of, in a way, we're reliving those things. And, there's a teaching of the Buddha, which is, I'm sure you've heard, which is the teaching of the two arrows. So somebody fires an arrow and it comes into somebody and it wounds them in the arm, let's say, in the arm. And it's very painful. It's not nice. It's bad enough. So this is like when we've done something bad, let's say, and then that was bad enough. But then when we relive it, it's like the second arrow. And it's like somebody shoots another arrow, and this time the second arrow goes in exactly the same place as the first arrow. And the pain is not just double, but it's even many more times more painful. Okay, you've already got a wound, and somebody puts another arrow in there. So when we relive things like this, and we feel bad again about it, okay, it's not great. And in terms of guilt, in terms of the teachings on Buddhist psychology, is guilt is like a seed in our mind that comes up. And guilt can have a wholesome and an unwholesome aspect to it. Okay, wholesome means that it's something that brings us joy and brings us happiness. Unwholesome means something that brings us discomfort, suffering, pain. Okay, it's pretty obvious. So the unwholesome way that guilt can manifest when it comes up is that we feel regret and we just reliving things over and over again, but we really don't resolve anything with that. Okay, it's just feeling bad. The other way that guilt can be, which is the way that the Buddha suggests that we deal with it, is that we understand we've done something wrong and we make a sort of determination to do better the next time. So the experience there that we have with it is such that it sort of motivates us, it gives us the intention, if you like to use that word, maybe. The intention to do better the next time. And we shouldn't be too hard on ourselves. Certainly in my generation, my parents were brought up, my dad is still alive, was brought up in the Depression, and they sort of had it pretty tough, but they were hard, and I was And sometimes they're hard, you know, their parents were hard on them. There wasn't much to eat. Maybe people have come from places where there's been, less food to eat. Or their parents have. So, they, you know, my dad was pretty hard on us. And, you know, sometimes I think, like, they wanted it to be perfect. But, you know, like we say, I don't think the idea of being perfect is realistic. Because we all make mistakes. That's how we learn. Confucius said there's three ways. Three ways to learn. he said imitation. Imitation was the easiest. So we learn by copying someone else. We learn by from a teacher, from a friend, a peer. We take a leaf out of somebody else's book. That's the first way. He said that's the easiest. The second way is by reflection. And this is one of the things that we can do in relation to our own actions and we've been talking about here. Looking at things with the eyes of compassion, looking at things with the eyes of interbeing or seeing the word that's used sometimes, I get my tongue wrapped around it, interdependent co-arising. So things, lots of different causes and conditions, and they all arise together. That's how manifestation comes about. So looking with those eyes, so reflecting on that and being able to look deeper, we can call that insight meditation, whatever we like to do, but reflecting. So it's nice to, at the end of the day, to just sit back and have a little bit of quiet time, be a little bit still, look back, what did I do today? How was my speech? How was my actions? What did I think about all day today? You can bet there were lots of things that you thought about more than once. Thoughts come round and round and round. That's why it's good to give your mind a rest. So reflection, the noblest. Confucius said the noblest. That's the noblest way of learning. And then the third way is our experience. And Confucius says that's the bitterest. That's where we really learn the hard way, by our own experience. Those that could really learn, you know, wow, I did that, oh, I'm so embarrassed. Not going to do that again. In reality, all of those things, again, can be like the pots, you know. It can be a combination of things. We can imitate some things. We can reflect on our own experience, you know. It can be a combination of all three or some of those. So I don't know why I came up with it. Now I've lost the train a little bit. I think I'll just change the theme completely here. There's a story that reminds me actually of the three pots. And one is a nun who went into a monastery and... I apologize if you've heard this story before. I only come here about once every year, so if you come to my talks every year, I forget what I said last time, even what the topic was about. So maybe you hear these things before. Anyway, this nun goes into this monastery, and it's one of those monasteries where the... nuns aren't allowed to talk, there's a... It's noble silence the whole time. It's really strict. No talking whatsoever. However, you know, they like to get a little bit of feedback. So once every 5 years, you're allowed to say three words. And this nun's been there for 5 years, and it's her first. And so she gets to see the abbess, or, you know, maybe... She's a Catholic nun, I don't know, maybe it's the Mother Superior. And so she comes in, and she's been thinking about this, what she's going to say. Sits down, Mother Superior sits there, nice smile, ready to listen to her. it comes out with food, no good. Another superior smiles. The nun gets up, she walks out. She's got to go back to her silence now, so for another 5 years. Next 5 years comes around. Same thing happens. Comes in, sits down. Everyone knows the procedure. Must be written down because you're not allowed to talk to people about it, but they know what it is. So she comes back 5 years later, this time, bed too hard. So for 5 years she's been thinking about this, what she's going to say, how she's going to say it in 3 words, and that's what she's come up with. 5 more years go by now. She's been there for 15 years. Well, comes in, sits down in front of the Mother Superior, same thing. I quit now. Mother Superior is sitting there very calmly still. She hasn't said anything back. Except this time she says, "Well, I'm not really surprised, dear. You've done nothing but complain ever since you've been here." Okay. That's the poison pot. That's the poison pot. So, the story that comes to mind for this about how we can, a really powerful story, which is a true story, I believe, from my own teacher. He did a lot of work with American veterans who were in the war in Vietnam. And at one of the retreats for veterans, one man had this regret about his actions that he'd done during the war. And what had happened was that his comrades had been killed in a village, and sometimes they would go into villages, and during the day they would be, say, the South Vietnamese army, or the people would be, you know, supporting the South Vietnamese. In the evening, the Viet Cong would come into the village, and then the people would have this dilemma because, you know, the North Vietnamese army would be there. And he felt very betrayed by the fact that his comrades had been killed in this village where they thought it was a safe village. And in his anger, what he did with him and another soldier was they put gunpowder, they made cookies, and they put gunpowder in the cookies and they left them outside the village. And sure enough, children in the village, this is pretty, you know, gory sort of story, the children in the village ate those and, you know, got very sick and died. They killed them. But this was on his mind, obviously, and it played on his mind. And this was years and years, 30 years maybe after he'd done this. He had never been able to go into a school, even, where there were school children again, because it reminded him of that incident. So his karma, in a way, was not something that was external. It was something that continually playing on his mind. And, you know, that's an aspect of karma for anything that we do. It's like, you know, his second arrow was a real powerful arrow. And then, so he asked this question. He told this story and asked that question, what can you do about that? And Thich Nhat Hanh, my teacher, said to him, well, you know, you can't change the past in a way, but what you can do now is, you know, just look at your actions going into the future. And what can you do that's going to bring joy to children? And I just planted a seed in that man, and then he obviously thought about that and gave him an intention to help children. And in fact, he ended up going back, I believe, to Vietnam to help poor children. So 10 years on from that again, you know, all of a sudden he's turned around that. Rather than just brooding on it all the time, rather than just feeling regret, he's taking another action to not necessarily change the past, but certainly to change his karma in that sense, his ongoing karma. So we shouldn't just think of karma in terms of bad karma, in terms of something that's been done, in terms of something that can't be undone. We can look at it in terms of ways that, you know, we can do another action. And, you know, that that man suffered less, and certainly there were children who benefited from him having that attitude or that change of mind. So it's. I think the other thing about I had the thought I had about the delete is that, like all things in Buddhism, they arise in our mind. So we can have anger or regret or that which is always on our mind. And then we are really like that when that is present. But we should know that we can't get surgery and have our mind taken out. It's not like we might have deluded mind. Sometimes we might call that deluded mind. Or maybe, you know, it's the poison pot or it's the full pot, whatever it is. We can transform that, though. It is possible to transform our mind, so we don't cut it out. In fact, it's said that true mind and deluded mind are—it's the same mind. We can imagine it like the image of an ocean. When the wind's blowing, when things there's a storm and the waves are really rough, it's the same ocean as when it's still, like when we're doing the meditation, and the ocean is perfectly still when it's calm. So that's like true mind. It's the same mind, it's the same ocean. And it's not like, well, you know, we were given this mind when we were born and we're stuck with it. We can transform our mind. We can have that transformation. So this is something that I wanted to read. Give everyone a copy so at least you can follow it. It's called Beginning Anew. It may have different names in different Buddhist traditions. So reading. Rather than listen to me still, is there anyone who'd like to read? Maybe there's five paragraphs here which we can all follow. Has got any volunteer readers? Even my kindy kids put their hands up and volunteer for reading. Do I have to pick people? All right. If you really want me to read, then I will. What about we all read together? Yeah, that's better. Okay, reading together is actually like a mindfulness exercise. We're not just sort of reading at our own pace. We've got to listen to the other voices in the choir. But we're not singing it, we're just reading it. So this is about how we can... We can start afresh. I think we just read it. And, you know, in monasteries they would read these things on a regular basis. So there's things in here that, you know, that take time to sink in. The first time we read them, we don't notice something. Or we may have we may find that we've got an attitude towards this when we think, oh, gee, this is a little bit, you know, moralistic, maybe. So we try not to have that judgment part of the poison pot when we read the thing, if we can. Just have an open mind. So please read it with me. Beginning anew. With great respect, we turn towards the conqueror of affliction, offering heartfelt words of repentance. We have lived in forgetfulness for a long time, as we have not had the opportunity to encounter the Dharma. Our habit energies have led us into suffering. We have made many mistakes out of unskillfulness. We have been blinded by our wrong perceptions for a very long time. Our heart's garden is sown with attachment, hatred, and pride. In us are seeds of killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, and lies. Everyday deeds and words do damage. All these wrong actions are obstacles to our peace and joy. Let us begin anew. We see that we have been thoughtless, straying from the path of mindfulness. We have stored up afflictions and ignorance, which have brought about so much aversion and sorrow. There are times because we are so full of anxiety, because we do not understand others, we are angry and resentful. First, we try to reason with each other, then we blame. Every day, the suffering increases, making the rift greater. There are days when we are unwilling to speak to each other, unwilling to look each other in the face, and we create internal formations which last for a long time. Now we turn to the three jewels, sincerely recognizing our errors. We bow our heads. We know so well have buried all the wholesome seeds, seeds of love and understanding, seeds of peace and joy. But because we do not know how to water them, the wholesome seeds do not sprout fresh and green. We continue to allow sorrow to overwhelm us until there is no light in our lives. When we chase after a distant happiness, life becomes but a shadow of the reality. Our mind is occupied by the past or worrying about this or that in the future. We cannot let go of our anger, and we consider of no value the precious gifts of life which are already in our hands, thereby trampling on real happiness. As month follows month, we are sunk in sorrow. So now, in the precious presence of the Buddha, fragrant with sandalwood incense, we recognize our errors and begin anew. With all our heart, we go for refuge, turning to the Buddha in the 10 directions, and all the Bodhisattvas, noble disciples, and self-achieved Buddhas. Very sincerely, we recognize our errors and the mistakes of our wrong judgments. Please bring the balm of clear water to pour on the roots of our afflictions. Please bring the raft of the true teachings to carry us over the ocean of sorrow. We vow to live an awakened life, to practice smiling and conscious breathing, and to study the teachings authentically transmitted. Diligently, we shall live in mindfulness. We come back to live in the wonderful present, to plant our heart's garden with good seeds, and to make strong foundations of understanding and love.
We vow to train ourselves in mindfulness and concentration, practicing to look and understand deeply, to be able to see the nature of all that is, and so to be free of the bonds of birth and death. We learn to speak lovingly, to be affectionate, to care for others, whether it is early morn or late afternoon, to bring the roots of joy to many places, helping people to abandon sorrow, to respond with deep gratitude to the kindness of parents, teachers and friends. With deep faith, we light up the incense of our heart. We ask the Lord of compassion to be our protector on the wonderful path of practice. We vow to practice diligently, cultivating the fruits of this path.
Searching for my reading glasses. Here they are. So, the practice of beginning anew is an actual practice that we can do at any time. We don't have to just wait till the end of the day even. It's about refreshing ourselves. It's about coming back to ourselves and resurrecting ourselves in a way. And it's starting again. It's maybe looking at our ideas. Maybe reframing what's happened in the past. You know, sometimes we're so sure about things that we've done and that we regret, but, you know, am I sure? And we've repeated that over and over because we've replayed that movie in our head so many times about things that we've done that we regret. But sometimes, you know, our experience, even though it's an unwholesome experience, even though it's not a good experience, a bad experience, whatever we want to give that name to it, you know, that can be the thing that instigates our intention to do better. We really don't want to, you know, go any lower than that, maybe. So, it can be something that's a good thing if it spurs us. So this is a book called Touching the Earth Has Guided Meditations in it, but it talks about beginning anew at the beginning. So lots of different guided meditations, but it starts with a poem, and the poem is, it goes like this: at the foot of the mountain there's a stream. Take the water from the stream and wash yourself, and you will be cured. That's it. It's about refreshing ourselves. So the word, it says here, the words are taken from a well-known beginning anew ceremony. And these words come from the Chinese words, Chen Hui. Anyone speak Chinese here? I'm not sure. C-H-A-N, Chen Hui. But does it probably not mean anything to you? But it means expressing our regret for mistakes we have made in the past, coupled with a deep and transforming determination to act differently from now on. Because we know that we can act differently, we do not feel guilt. I think that's That's sort of a summary of this this reading that we've just done. Because we know we can act differently, we don't need to feel guilt. And it's not like pressing delete so much as maybe pressing reset. So I think that's all that I had to say. And now, given that it's 8:30, we can have the question box, or people can ask questions if we still have questions. No questions. Okay, we can all go home. So, I mean, yes, we've got a question at the back.
About questions, but I'm thinking differently about the karma. It's on the pattern weekly email. She mentions that karma is one of the central of Buddhist teaching. But in my opinion, karma is not one of the central of the Buddhist teaching, because karma is already there before the Buddha itself. So, in my opinion, that's karma is not one of the central of Buddhist teaching. How do you think?
So, you're saying that the idea of karma was around before the Buddha?
Yes, yeah. It's there since the Brahmin era.
Mm-hmm.
And I think karma is one of the law of nature itself.
I think there were many things that were around before the the Buddha. If we look at the causes and conditions of the Buddha, I mean, he had many teachers.
Yeah.
Even when he left the palace, I mean, he was lucky as a young prince to have very good teachers available to him. But even when he left the palace, he sought out spiritual teachers. And at that time in India, there were a lot of different teachers and a lot of different schools of thought. So the Buddha listened to those teachers, but he wasn't happy, and that's why he sat under the Bodhi tree. He did take on a lot of things. Meditation itself, I think, was something that obviously had been around, as you say, in the Brahmin tradition. You only have to look in, we think of yoga today as something really about exercise for our body and taking care of our body, but in the yoga tradition there is a tradition of meditation and an understanding of the mind. So there were many things around like karma, and some of those things I think the Buddha accepted and included in his own teachings. But I think a lot of those things he had a different view, a different philosophy on at the time. So I'm not sure about specifically about karma, and it was around before, but I think there were different conceptions of karma at the time, just as there are today, I think. And there were misconceptions about it. People simplified it as they do today. And I think it's not just karma. Karma is a pretty good example of it, but I think often in in spiritual tradition, sometimes they get oversimplified and the real meaning gets missed, and it can seem like superstition. So I think karma falls into that category. A lot of people have like a superstitious view of karma. Oh, that person did something bad, they'll get payback for that. Should be tomorrow. Oh, that person did something good, they'll win lotto next week. it doesn't always work like that. Sometimes karma can be related to not just things that have happened in our life, but we may carry traits or habits that are, you know, are in our genes, maybe. And maybe, you know, if we look deeply, that's where people can say that, you know, it can come from, not just from this life, we can have karma from. It's all a way of how you look at it, but I think the main thing about karma is action. Who said karma was action? Yeah. So what we can, I think, concentrate on with karma is what can we do about it? What actions can we do? What speech can we do to make our karmic results good? And if we have kind speech, all of the things that are in this, then... I think my experience is that it is interesting how things come around, how you get that kindness back. And it's not, you don't do things to get things back. And it doesn't necessarily happen like instantly. It's not an instant transaction. It's not like I give money and I get the material goods that I want to buy straight away. But generally speaking, you get more kindness and wholesome. You have more happiness and joy in your life. I think so. I think we need to be like that man and look. What can we do now? Whatever we've done in the past, and just move on with that.
Yes. Still on the email, it's like the pressing deletes. It's happened with if we read the story about Angulimala, how he with the wrong view killed so many people, but then he achieved arhatship, and those bad karma can be deleted at his life. But in other stories, we also read about many arahant, although they reach arahantship, but they still receive a bad karma from the past. So in my opinion, there is a possibility of pressing the delay button on the karma. It's my view on the when I in more Theravada traditions teaching.
Yeah, I wonder what you mean by the pressing the delete, though. Does that mean that you you do enough good karmic actions to sort of cancel out, and there's an accountant there who keeps sort of, you know, double-digit accounting and sort of saying, well, okay, Angulimala, you're okay now because, you know, the balance sheet is it's all squared off, you know. You've got 100 people's fingers around your neck that you've killed, but you know, you've done all these good things, and that cancels it all out. Is that what pressing delete means? Is that what people understand?
Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, there is a possibility for the karma in the past. It's not causing you harm at the present life.
Well, certainly Angulimala is a great example of somebody who you know, was turned around. And he viewed things differently. He saw things differently. You know, he at the time when the Buddha told him to stop, and he sort of said, "Well, you know, it's a pity I didn't meet you earlier because you know, it's too late for me." And the Buddha said, "You know, it's never too late." I don't know if you got the end of Angulimala's story, though. He didn't have a very pleasant end. People who were relatives of people who he'd killed found him and recognized him as a monk many years later and basically beat him to death. So the delete button didn't quite work for him in that sense. I'm not saying that, you know, you can look at that. I don't think that it's helpful to think of karma in terms of like a bank account. Well, I made all these withdrawals and I had all this debt, but I've paid the loan back now. It's okay. You know, I think that's I don't think that's helpful in terms of karma, because, you know, I think that causes and conditions, this is where we look with causes and conditions, and there's never one cause or condition, and there are many causes and conditions. It's very hard to see all of them and to understand them all. And, you know, there is never one cause and condition, so we just can't say that we do something, I think, and that's cancelled out something from the past, because there will be other things that came about because of that too.
I have a question. What does your take on people who always think like, today is a bad day, my boss hit my face, slapped my face, as well as yesterday, but I think it's because of my bad karma that I did in my previous life, so I'll just accept this karma, and it keeps repeating and repeating. What is your take on that kind of view?
I think we need to stop and to reflect on our own behavior. I think we learn that if somebody hits us, maybe then we have to look at what are the reasons behind that as best we can, and maybe we can understand it and maybe we can't. I think we have to look at our own behaviour as well and what we can do, what's the skillful things to do in a situation. So your example is that you've been a victim, maybe bullied, or someone's in a position of power where they're abusing their power over you.
Well, it could be like simple things like you step on the stool. Accidentally step on the stool, you drop your phone on the toilet, some bad stuff, and then you say, oh, this must be the cause of my bad karma.
So, and that's like, I think that's a very superficial way to look at it, and that's not looking deeply at the situation. Okay, so that's just like trying to make an excuse as to why that happened without really doing the work of looking deeply and trying to get insight from the incident. If you always do that, then you're never really going to look at the underlying causes. And I think it's helpful to continue to hold something like that. Okay, you may not see the reasons for something straight away, or you may not see all of them straight away. But we hold things, and a lot of things with me, I go to bed and I've got a question on my mind, or I don't understand something, and I wake up in the morning or I wake up in the middle of the night, and then all of a sudden the answer's just there. Sometimes we've got too many things on our mind, but to just sweep it away like that, I think, is maybe trying to press the delete button. You just say, well, I wish this karma would go away, so it's just my karma, I don't need to think about it. And I don't think that's... I don't think you're ever going to get an answer if you keep doing that.
But one of the arguments said that if you do that, you keep yourself in the patient state, so you don't get angry.
I see.
You don't act spontaneously.
Of course. I think that, the whole thing about looking, how we look at karma and understanding it, means that we don't get caught up in the situation, and we're better able to deal with it. We don't get upset with the other person if we try to understand them. So if it's more that I understand there's lots of causes and conditions here, and I need to look at them, and I need to sort of just step back and not react, then that is a good thing if it helps you to do that. But I really think, in any situation where we have an interaction with someone else, as you do there, there are two two people involved. It's not just the other person. We are not separate. We can't separate ourselves from that happening. So in that situation, you know, maybe we're at least 50% a part of what's happened. And so sometimes the easy thing to do, particularly with self, is just to look out and we blame the other person. Well, it's that person's fault. Yeah, everything's there. But we should look at our own interaction in that situation as well. Only because there's a tendency for us not to. You know, it's easier to blame the other person. It's easier to look at the other person, just say it's their fault, and thereby not look at how we behave or we're a part of it.
Hey, I may not understand everything you say. You say something like if you think that you can do better, you don't have to. I'm sorry. You don't have to regret. Is that what you say? Like if you think that your action can be better, you don't have to regret things.
You don't have to feel guilt.
Yeah. But then I feel that the regret itself will keep coming back, right? And that will cause like suffering. But then if you like, it is not like just instantly where you think that okay. So I feel that my action will be better than this thought will just go away. So
let's say this is a bag and I fill it up with really heavy stones.
Yeah.
And all of those stones that I put in here, my anger, my regret, my guilt, all of a sudden it's done again. And you've got to carry it around. And it weighs, you know, now it's like, I don't know. How much is a bag of cement?
Okay.
And then imagine that you've got to carry that around for the whole of your life. Okay. It's not much fun. So at some point, you have to let it go and you've got to be able to put it down. It might be sadness, it might be grief, you know, it might be a feeling of loss. We don't want to carry those things around. So at some time we have to learn to let go of them.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that you can drop it like at that moment, but then later on I'm sure
it'll
right?
But at least I've put it down for a little bit. So okay, I've had a little bit of a rest. You might have to pick it up again, okay? But when you pick it up, after you put it down, it just feels a little bit lighter. Maybe it's not lighter, but it's easier. Because you haven't been carrying it around the whole time. So we have to learn to be able to put these things down. And, you know, if we practice putting them down and down, they get a little bit lighter, sure, the thing may come back again. But when we practice in the positive way of dealing with guilt, for instance, then we think, okay, that was something that was my experience, I did it. But I'm not gonna keep beating myself up about it. I'm gonna do something from now on, from this moment on, I'm gonna do something that is much more positive and it's gonna be better. And the next time that the same circumstances occur, I'm not gonna make the same mistake, you know? My intention is not to. Or I'm gonna be better at it next time. Just get a little bit better. So, you know, if we we've only got one life, so I think we have to look at this idea of being able to transform ourselves. And you know, a lot of our karma can be the habit energy of our parents. It may not be in our genes, it may be just in the way they brought us up. Okay, the things they told us, and you know, sometimes our parents tell us things about, you know, how we're to behave. And And we don't question it. We never look at it. We just take it as the truth. Well, that must be right. So reflection on these things, and that can be our karma, you know. And sometimes those things can be not so good things that get handed down. Sometimes our parents have unskillful things. I know maybe you've got perfect parents. You know my view on perfect. But at some point, if we don't transform the unwholesome things that have been passed down to us, then all we will do is pass them on to our children as well. So at some point, it's like, you know, all the sheets in this book, and I have some ink, and it goes through the pages, and it keeps going through. At some point, there's got to be a pure page. We've got to purify our mind. And we can do that so that we don't continue to pass that. And that's, you know, we transform that habit energy. So to some extent, like, we shouldn't see those things as fixed either. Things that are in our mind, like guilt, like anger, like sadness, you know, they come and they go. We're not there permanently. We're not actually angry people. We're not anxious people. We're not born anxious. There's a seed within us of anxiety or anger or sadness that comes up. And it comes, it's there for a while, and then it goes. And we can learn how to deal with that so that it's not as strong, especially if it's an unwholesome formation within us. But if we identify with things, then that's sort of the self clinging, wanting to cling to it. You know, oh, I'm just an angry person. I can't help it. No, again, that's just... I always say things like that. Well, you know, you just have to put up with it. I'm just like that. You know, that's sort of that's sort of putting a block and taking the easy way out and not accepting that you can transform yourself. You can, you know, you can change. Everything is impermanent. Everything can change. Any other questions? When I ask my kindergarten class or even year 5 and 6, you know, have you got any questions? And someone puts their hand up and they say, how old are you? That's the most common question I get. There was one little verse I didn't read in here. I'm gonna read it. And, it goes like this. It's a little four-line gatha. All wrongdoing arises from the mind. When the mind is purified, what trace of wrong is left? After repentance, my heart is light, like white clouds that have always floated over ancient forests in freedom. You know, we can nourish things like kindness, like joy. When I wake up in the morning, I have this little poem that I say, and I've been saying it more regularly lately, but it reminds me to be grateful of the things that I have. So it's a part of what the Buddha taught. There's a sutra which is called the 16 Full Awareness of Breathing. It's a well-known sutra, the Anapanasati. And in relation to the mind, the first thing is to be aware of your mind. What's on your mind at the moment? So it might be you might be feeling guilty, or you might be feeling angry or sad. You might be worried. You might have doubts. All of these things. But just what is it? What's your mind doing now? You just stop during the day. When we say stop, breathe and smile, it means stop. And you know, what am I thinking now? What am I doing now? And so I have this little garter, and it goes, waking up this morning, I smile. 24 brand new hours ahead of me. I vow to live each one fully and look at myself and the world with the eyes of compassion. So you just develop those good things in you. Kindness, compassion, joy, non-judgment, non-discrimination. All of those things. You need to bring those things into your mind during the day. You need to know how to gladden your mind, how to make your mind joyful. And when you know how to do those things, you just have to practice it. You know, there's no excuse for not doing it. Someone's told you that that's how you should do it. And you know, then there were four things in that thing about the mind. That the other four things that the Buddha said were to be able to concentrate the mind, so you can develop that longer period of mindfulness or awareness. And the last one is to free your mind, and it free your mind from affliction, free your mind from always feeling guilt, from anger, from being controlled by or enslaved by those things. So, that's from the Buddha. And you can't really be happy unless you're free. Always enjoy coming here, because I think you guys have a great opportunity to discuss these things with yourselves. You know, sit around and have a discussion about these things and just share. You know, one person speaks at a time. And I have in the children's class, I use a talking stick. Okay, we learn when someone else is talking. What's the rule with a talking stick? Only that person talks. Everybody else has to listen. And that's a great way to do things, because these days people don't have an opportunity to be listened to. And I know you guys hear all these Dharma talks all the time. You know more about Buddhism than I do, probably, and you have all these great teachers coming along. So there's a lot of wisdom here, and when you put it all together, you've got 20 people here, or 15 people, I don't know how many, but the sum of the parts is greater than those 15 together. There's a lot of wisdom when you bring a collective experience. So, make the most of it.